The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
We begin with a slight dip in the annual rate of inflation.
That's right. Prices were up 8.5% in July compared to last year, but that is slightly down from the four-decade high in June when inflation hit 9.1%.
Today, Sweden and Finland are one step closer to joining the NATO alliance. President Biden signing the NATO accession protocols for the two countries just moments ago.
Putin thought he could break us apart. Instead, he's getting exactly what he did not want.
A spectacular FBI search on former President Donald Trump's Florida home to reportedly seize official papers. Donald Trump issued a statement condemning what he called an unannounced raid to prevent him from running for the White House again.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
There were two very big news items this week, with one having immediate influence on the financial markets, while the second was just as big, but its effect won't be seen for some time. The first of which is the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, which passed in the Senate on Sunday, and it is expected to pass on Friday with the House of Representatives vote. This is a sweeping bill with some changes we'll see soon. According to NPR, these include tax credits for people switching to electric vehicles and rooftop solar panels. The Internal Revenue Service will get funding to boost its workforce to improve response time on refunds and increase collection. Subsidies for healthcare insurance premiums slated to expire next year will continue. The bill will create about $2,000 annual cap on out-of-pocket prescription drugs for senior citizens on Medicare. And the bill will instill a minimum 15% tax on corporations making over $1 billion, in addition to a new excise tax on corporate stock buybacks to help pay for a lot of the subsidies. So this isn't as much about spending as it is about trade-offs, which NPR quoted from Kent Smetters, who is a faculty director of the Penn Wharton budget model, which he said doesn't add to inflation, but doesn't really take away from the rise in prices either. The passing of the bill had a muted effect on stocks on Monday and on bond yields, with the S&P 500 closing down 5 points, 10-year note falling 8 basis points to 2.77%, and the 2-year falling only 3 basis points to 3.2%. Despite the news, the bill would likely pass on Friday. Friday's rally was more regarded as a buy-the-dip move following Thursday's weak showing than on the likely pass of the bill. Moving to our second item, which was really the key that did move the market, was the Consumer Price Index, which was released for July on Wednesday. Total CPI was unchanged, down 0.1% for the month, while the core CPI was up 0.3% month to month. The year-over-year change was the big headline, and that number was a deceleration from 9.1 previously down to 8.5. So while the headline number was a welcome support of the idea we've seen peak inflation, it is being presumed that this will also support the idea that the Fed can reduce future rate hikes in months to come and then transition to rate cuts in the first half of 2023. So this is largely some of the news that supported the ongoing rally we've been seeing since early July. But before I talk about what the Fed officials have had to say this week, and after the CPI print, what they've had to say, I wanted to steer your attention to a video Research Affiliates released that provides some very valuable insight on the recent drop, both structurally as well as mechanically, just how the rate of increase decelerated, and what would happen if future monthly changes were either flat or went up slightly. So let's focus on a key point here with Campbell Harvey, partner and head of research at Research Affiliates.
So one thing with CPI, it's really difficult to forecast the next month, but you know what you're dropping. So the observation 12 months ago, you're actually dropping. So that you know for sure. The announcement today effectively drops that 0.48%, and then it adds the number that we saw today, which was effectively 0% or negative 0.01%. So when you drop that high number and replace it with a lower number, then that actually reduces the inflation rate. And we saw that we went from 9.1% to 8.5% today. So what I want to do, because people are thinking, oh, well, inflation has stopped, so we'll quickly get back to 2 or 3%. And that's definitely not the case. It's not the case mechanically, and it's not the case structurally.
And by the way, we'll be posting this video on our website where we also post this podcast. But if you want to watch that video later, Campbell Harvey explains how structurally there is a very, very low probability that inflation will get back down to 2 and 3% by the end of this year, as owner's equivalent rent, a very large portion of the index, will stay persistently high. And if energy continues to rise like it did this week, up 6% for oil, we could see that month-over-month rate go back up, and that could re-accelerate inflation's pace. So while the year-over-year rate has changed as the comparisons for 12 months ago before Ukraine and its effect on food and energy prices fall off, we are likely to see persistent inflation for some time. Now let's turn to the Fed speak this week to see if investors are right, that with a deceleration in inflation, we could see peak Fed hikes with smaller increases in our future. So as I mentioned earlier, we have heard from many Fed speakers. This week, we heard from Fed Governor Bowman, FOMC voter. She said that another 75 basis point hike is likely in September. And that's how she sees it. And that was on Monday before the CPI print. After the CPI data had been released Wednesday, Chicago Fed President Evans, while not a voter right now, said he expects rates to top out at 4%, but also said if things get better more quickly on the inflationary front, I suppose, we cannot raise rates quite as much. Now, Minneapolis Fed President Kashkari said he thinks rates finish at 3.9%, so pretty close to what Evans is saying, but said the Fed is far, far, far away from declaring victory on inflation. And as of the end of this week, investors are predicting, so looking at the CME FedWatch tool, there's a 57.5% probability that we see a 50 basis point hike instead of 75 in September, and there's a 42.5% probability of another 75 basis point hike. So still, that's pretty close to 50-50. In other news, there was some important earnings warnings from NVIDIA and Micron that led to some weakness earlier in the week for the semiconductor industry. Additionally, there were some meme stocks that saw huge gains, like Bed Bath & Beyond, almost up 40% Monday, and also AMC Entertainment, also up pretty big on no news, just speculation. Other important news that didn't quite move the market, but possibly the sector, was the announcement of an increase in Berkshire Hathaway's position in Occidental Petroleum that seemed to boost the energy sector this week. It was also helped by a 6% rise in energy for oil. Also, there was some weakness in Chinese American depository receipts, which are just the American listings of foreign stocks, on Friday, and that was for China Life Insurance, PetroChina, China Petroleum, Aluminum Corp China, and Shanghai Petroleum, to delist from the NYSE, putting pressure on these stocks as well as the likes of Alibaba and Baidu should they also plan to delist. Given China unexpectedly continued its military exercises outside Taiwan and the move to delist stocks in the U.S. this week, I think tensions are growing and not easing between the U.S. and China. Some things to watch closely politically. Up next, we're going to give Chris and Chris a lot of room to expand on the big picture this week as we skip the technician and guest expert and go straight into Smart Macro. Up next.
You're talking about how this is a bubble that's about to burst. Are you hearkening back to the 2005 housing bubble? I mean, in terms of impacts and the magnitude of what we could see?
It's a bubble and it's starting to break and there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering. But nothing like what we had with the subprime. You know, you had back then where people could borrow 100% of the appraised value of a house for a mortgage, and the appraisals were overinflated. And then they could borrow another 20, 30% so-called home improvement loans. So they were borrowing 120, 130% of an overappraised property. Well, when the whole thing collapsed, obviously there was a lot of blood on the floor. You haven't had that kind of excesses. Yes, there has been a lot of exuberance in housing. Yes, a lot of people have stretched to buy housing they really can't afford. And the statistics that I mentioned, you decided, of housing selling much higher in relation to incomes even than it was back in the bubble. But it's not as widespread. It's not the issue. But housing is important to the economy. Housing is so heavily leveraged. You think about somebody puts down 3% on an FHA mortgage. That's a 33 and a third times leverage. That's a huge leverage. If anything goes wrong, their equity is wiped out. So they're in trouble. And when housing gets in trouble, it's not just that 3.5% in housing. It's all the home furnishing. It's the brokerage commissions. It's the relocation costs. It's easily double that amount. You know, some estimates are that ultimately it affects about 10% of the economy. So when housing is in trouble, it has a widespread effect.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939. Or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us for today's edition of Smart Macro is Chris Poplava, our Chief Investment Officer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. Now, Chris, before we get into the macro story, some of the fundamentals that you're looking at, let's talk about the technical outlook. One of the technical milestones that's getting a lot of discussion is that the stock market has now broken through the 50% retracement level. And I know you did an extensive study looking at this through prior bull and bear markets and what this means for the future outlook. Can you tell us about your study and what this has to say about the current outlook?
What I did is I went all the way back to 1950, so basically post-World War II. And my criteria for my study was that, number one, you had to technically be in a bear market, meaning you had to have fallen at least 20% from your high. Once that happened, I looked at every significant bounce, and I looked to see on a closing basis, how much did it recover of the prior decline? And what I found is a consistent pattern was that we had never exceeded half of the market decline and retracing that in a dead cat bear market bounce. We were very close in 2001, but then obviously we had 9/11, which pushed the market lower. So that, you know, could have gone on to exceed that 50% mark had it not been for the terrorist attacks, but it still did not exceed that 50% retracement level. So that's why, you know, once we started to bottom at the June lows, I was really curious to see where that level was and how the market would behave. So yesterday we exceeded that 50% mark on the S&P, but we didn't close above it. Today, right now, the S&P is at 4250, and the 50% retracement is roughly around 4231. So we're, you know, roughly 20 points above that. So the odds are, by retracing half of the bear market, that the lows are in. At least that's what history would suggest.
So Chris, as you said, you conducted this study looking at the S&P 500, right? So that's the main index that you were looking at. Did I get that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And if I understood what you said correctly, it's the 4231 level on the S&P 500 at which we would have now seen a 50% retracement. So at this point, it sounds like based on what you said in this historical study going back to 1950, that the probability is lining up that we did see the ultimate bottom in June and that it looks like we would now be in a new bull market. Is that what the odds are saying based on this study?
Correct. You know, when we look at history, every time we've exceeded that 50% mark, we were in officially a new bull market and we did not go on to hit new lows. So as long as any pullbacks from here are shallow, that would add further evidence to the bulls that the bottom is likely in. But if we have a sizable correction, it means the bear's not ready to basically give up, that there's still some fight left in the bear, that we basically are in a sideways market. Or this could be the first time where, you know, this study fails, that we go on to hit new lows. So again, what the bulls do not want to see is a double-digit pullback from here. Same thing with the bears, though, right? Unless we hit new lows, the bears can't declare victory. So I'm basically trying to outline the scenarios that we have not seen, and just something to be aware of to understand what a bull or bear trap would look like.
One thing that we will often reference on our show is the three-legged stool analogy for understanding the market. There's the technicals, there's the fundamentals, and then there's the politicals. And the politicals we define as really fiscal and monetary policy, right? So how much liquidity is being injected into the market and the economy, both by the U.S. government on the fiscal side and then by the Federal Reserve, the central bank, on the monetary side. Given what you said, at this point, the technicals are now lining up that we've seen a bear market bottom as of June. There would be a lower likely scenario that we continue the bear market from here. But again, we are in a very unusual investment environment here, especially when we think about post-COVID and changes that have taken place in the character of the market, the amount of money printing that's taking place directly injected into people's wallets, and just turning off the economy in 2020 like a power button with the lockdown. So, you know, that could certainly disrupt a lot of these historical cycles. That said, the technicals are lining up that we may have seen the bottom as of June. The fundamentals, however, as you've pointed out, are still deteriorating. I mean, if you look at the forward-looking leading economic indicators, they're still pointing for an ongoing slowdown, especially when we think about housing, if we look at even the Conference Board's leading economic indicator and a wide range of others, and the politicals as well. There's still monetary tightening. We haven't seen a Fed pivot. So really at this point, and I want to see if this is something you would agree with, the technicals are really the only thing at this point lining up for a more bullish scenario, where the other two legs of the stool are still pointing for ongoing deterioration. Would you agree with that?
You know, Chris, I would, again, and this is why I'm hesitant to flip to a bull. I do think the odds of hitting new lows have definitely gone down given the strength in the market. But, you know, another study that I have done, and, you know, I've been able to do this going back to the Great Depression, and it's worked really well. Essentially, it's tracking the slope of the 200-day moving average for the S&P. And just looking at the slope does a really good job of helping to understand if you're in a bull or bear market. So, you know, when the upward slope is rising, that really reinforces the primary trend is up. You're in a bull market. When that slope is falling, that means the primary trend is down and you're in a bear market. So if you just look at the S&P's returns, they are significantly higher when the S&P is above its 200-day moving average and it's upward sloping versus if it was below a downward sloping moving average. So essentially, Chris, you know, just looking at the 200-day, it's a really good filter for you to understand bull or bear markets. Very simple to define. And again, this is why, you know, while there's maybe one more chip in the bull's favor, the primary trend is down if you just looked at the 200-day moving average. That turned down starting in May of this year. So the slope is down and the S&P is below that. So ideally, we would want to see the S&P above a rising moving average. Right now, that is flipped upside down. We are below a 200-day. So for me, that's still, and when you use that filter, that would still suggest we're not out of this bear market yet. So, you know, we're quickly running up into the 200-day moving average, which right now rests at 43.28 on the S&P. We're basically a stone's throw away from that. However, it's still downward sloping. And so basically the slope of the moving average, that's almost like gravity. You rally into that, but that's the dominant force. And that basically tells you that there was a lot of technical damage done, and it likely will take some time to repair that. So to really start to flip towards more of the bullish camp, you'd want to see the market above that. You'd want to see it flatten, if not steepen, and that would give you a lot more confidence that the bear market is over and we're now in a new bull market. But as of right now, I don't see that. And further, Chris, you know, if you just look at pure technical analysis and you draw trend lines, when you look at the market, we're still in a downward trend. So, for example, when you look at multiple markets like the S&P, if you look at its January, connect that line through its April high, we're bumping into that, but we're not through that. So when you just look at the trend is still down. If you look at the NASDAQ, we're basically bumping into that downward trend. So that's not definitively broken. The S&P 500 large cap is not definitively broken at this point. And when you look at even the S&P mid cap, S&P 400 index, that too is bumping at the underside of that trend line. So, you know, this is a key place as well. It's not just that 50% mark, you know, pure traditional technical analysis of drawing trend lines. We're not through that. The one area that I would say we are is in the small cap Russell 2000. That has clearly broken its bearish trend line, where really the top was in 21, not 2022. And when you look at that November peak and draw a line through the March-April high, we are well above that by almost 100 to 200 points. So a clear break, that bearish intermediate trend is done for small cap stocks, but that's still very much in play for mid cap, large cap, and then the broad-based NASDAQ. So again, breaking through all of those trend lines across multiple major indices, that would then push more chips in favor of the bulls. So we haven't seen that yet, and that's something to bear in mind. Plus the fact that the 200-day moving averages are downward sloping for most major indices, it's very premature, I believe, for the bulls to declare victory. And so definitely something to keep in mind and something to continue watching in the days and weeks ahead.
Okay, so that's, again, the technical picture. And referencing the three-legged stool again, we also have the fundamentals and the politicals when we think about fiscal and monetary policy as part of that political leg. What is your assessment of those two other legs?
Well, you know, that's a really good point that you bring up, Chris. And, you know, a single study, you can always have a first time in history, right? So, you know, investing is not that easy. While rules of thumb can certainly help you, you have to really kind of step back and look at the big picture. And from my vantage point, when we look back at the last 10 years, every major market bottom has had a catalyst. Whether it was a change in monetary policy or a change in leading economic indicators inflecting such that the economy's growth rate was likely to accelerate, which thereby means corporate earnings and sales would accelerate and drive the market higher. I do not see a bottom in earnings for the S&P or, you know, the corporations in general. That, I think, is still going to be slowing well into the end of this year. So I don't see a bottom in that front. When we look at LEIs, there's no sign of a bottom. In fact, when we look at leading relationships that I would call long leading indicators, those are pointing that the leading economic indicators like the ISM, other things like jobless claims, that those will likely continue to worsen well for the remainder of this year and well into 2023. An example of that is the change in interest rates. So, you know, when interest rates fall, it's very similar to the economy. It makes housing more affordable. It makes auto loans more affordable. It makes everything more affordable. And it increases profit margins for corporations as their financing costs go down. And so, you know, when we look at the change in the 10-year treasury yield, we had a massive, massive spike in interest rates. And what history has shown is that changes in interest rates over the prior 2 years, that leads roughly around, you know, a year and a half to 2 years in terms of looking at the S&P's earnings per share or, for example, the ISM manufacturing index. So we have not seen a sizable decline in interest rates. So we're still dealing with the aftermath of past tightening. It's often at times we say that, you know, when the Fed raises rates, they do so until something breaks. And it's very, very rare to see a soft landing. The reason for that is, again, what the Fed does not fully impact the economy until well after a year later, which means that rate hike that we just had in July of 75 basis points, we're not going to feel the impact of that until next year. So often at times, by the time the Fed sees that the economy is slowing down, it's too late to stop it. And one of the things I sent, Chris, I think it's important to bring out, that's important to point out to everyone, is reminding everyone what the Fed's mandate is, right? The Fed's mandate is really two things: price stability and full employment. Well, here's the reason why the Fed gets it wrong. That's looking in the rearview mirror. When you look at the conference board, they have three indexes: a leading economic index, a coincident, and a lagging index. Guess what goes into the lagging index for the conference board that historically typically peaks after the economy peaks? That's the CPI. The Fed right now is fixated on the CPI, which historically almost always peaks after a recession has begun. That is one of the main reasons why the Fed gets it wrong time and time again, where they push us into a recession. And even if they flip course, the damage has already been done. Secondarily, the other part of their mandate is full employment. Well, guess what? You look at the conference board, payrolls are in the coincident index. So you can see that at best, if the Fed is looking at coincident data, if the market is already, if the economy is already turned, it's too late. It's turned. So, that's not helpful. And certainly looking at inflation, which is the lagging indicator, is not helpful. So I'm bringing that up because everyone is elated that maybe the Fed is getting ready to pivot. Well, history has not been favorable to the Fed in terms of them preventing a recession and engineering a soft landing. So the risk of a recession is real. It's very real. And during recessions, on average, the S&P falls more than 30%. So we haven't even hit the average decline if we're ultimately going to go into a recession. We could hit new lows from here if we do end up officially falling in a recession where corporate earnings take a huge hit. And I still think that's quite likely. So again, that's why it's very hard for me to declare victory just based on that alone. When you look at leading indices that the conference board puts in there, one of them is jobless claims. It is exceptionally rare to see the market rally when jobless claims are rising. And that's exactly what we're dealing with right now. So either jobless claims have it wrong or the stock market has it wrong. That would be the assumption because it's very rare that they diverge. And we have seen consistently week after week after week since March that jobless claims are rising. Jobless claims lead non-farm payrolls, always. So the fact that jobless claims are rising tells us to expect smaller and smaller payroll growth. And if they rise sufficiently from here, we could actually see outright employment declines later this year going into next year. So that's why I think it is very premature to get bowled up here, to think the bear market is done, because we're missing that catalyst. And I still think the pain from the economy is still not fully priced in yet. I think that still lays ahead of us.
So again, in using this framework that we've cited many times on the three-legged stool, when you look at the technicals, the fundamentals, and the politicals, which includes fiscal and monetary policy, the technical picture is mixed. There is a bullish case that we saw the bear market bottom in June when you consider that we've retraced, at least as of today, 50% retracement off the lows. The fundamental picture, or leg, however, is showing that we should expect ongoing deterioration in the economic outlook. When you look at the leading economic indicators, and no sign for a turnaround there. Housing also going to be a significant drag on GDP moving forward, given that, as Gary Schilling said on FS Insider this week, that we're in the midst of a bursting housing bubble. He doesn't liken that to the 2005 housing bubble in terms of magnitude and impacts, but does say that we are in the process of unwinding or bursting from a housing bubble. That is going to be a headwind for the economy moving well into 2023, he believes. And on the political side, when we think about monetary policy, the Fed is still tightening. It may not be tightening as much as was expected based on the inflation outlook, which we all hope is in the process of waning, but they are still tightening. So when you look at those, as you said, you don't think it's time just to go all into the market at this point and declare victory, because we still see headwinds in those two others. And on the technical picture, we still have long-term momentum averages, the 200-day moving average, to contend with as well. So I guess as we've been discussing this week on FS Insider and as many in the financial media are discussing, you know, it seems that one of the big catalysts for the strong market reaction, at least this week, is the idea that we're going to see a peak in inflation. We saw that from 9.1% down to 8.5% on the overall inflation level, 0% month over month, as Biden has said, and he's getting a lot of flack for. But year over year, we went from 9.1 to 8.5 for the month of July. So the market is really embracing that as a sign that, oh, the Fed's not going to have to be as aggressive. And so it's off to the races. I don't think there's much that we can celebrate from going from 9.1 to 8.5. I mean, we're still at, you know, multi-decade highs here. But that being said, what are you looking at that would be for you a sufficient catalyst to say, okay, we now need to be putting a lot of that cash that you raised, that you started raising late last year and into beginning of this year, putting that back to work?
That's a good point, Chris, because, you know, when you look at the market in terms of deconstructing its returns, you know, what are the main drivers? One is earnings growth, and the second are valuations. So basically, what are investors willing to pay for a dollar of earnings? One of the most commonly used metric is the price, or the PE, price multiple. So basically, that's the price of the market per share divided by the earnings per share. That's the PE multiple. If you take your PE multiple, you multiply that by the earnings per share, that basically gives you the price for the market. And so when you project out where you think the price multiple is going to be and where you think earnings will be, that's how you can come up with a price target for the market, you know, whether you're looking at 6 months, a year, or even longer. And so when you look at that, market returns are typically either, they're basically income plus a change in the price multiple, plus a change in earnings. Those are really the three drivers of the market. And when I look at, for example, we already touched on this, when I look at where earnings are likely to go, when you look at the past tightening by the Fed and by the market itself in terms of changes in long-term interest rates, those argue that S&P earnings year over year are likely to turn negative as we close out this year going into next year. So I don't see earnings accelerating. I see them decelerating. So for the market to basically tread water and to run in place, if earnings are set to decline, we have to see investors willing to pay more for a given dollar of earnings than they're paying right now. So that's what the market needs to stay in place, if I'm correct, that earnings are going to decline from here. Now, what I've found that often basically drives valuations are basically animal spirits, fear and greed. Greed being you're willing to pay anything for a dollar of earnings, high valuations. Fear being you're not willing to pay much for a dollar of earnings, and PE multiples go down. And what often drives animal spirits of fear and greed is market liquidity. When, you know, the Fed is printing money, there's a lot of money going around to chase stock prices higher, valuations begin to expand. Conversely, you know, it's like when Warren Buffett says, only when the tide goes out, you see who's been swimming naked. Well, when the liquidity tide goes out, that often drives price multiples down. And as you recall, Chris, you and I discussed almost weekly, almost every smart macro segment late last year, one of my primary concerns for the S&P was that we were seeing a significant peak in liquidity, whether it's looking at US-based liquidity or global liquidity, it was falling sharply on a growth rate basis. That was arguing that we would likely see price multiples come down. Now, flipping that, looking backwards, the only way really, if price multiples go down for the market to tread water, earnings have to accelerate. Well, earnings really are not accelerating. That price multiples come down, and so stock prices have fallen. And so, you know, one of the proxies I use to kind of have a bearing on liquidity is looking at global money supply. So I'm basically looking at the world's biggest central banks, looking at the M2 money supply, and I'm rebasing that in dollars, given most of the world trades in dollars. So, for example, you know, if the Bank of Japan is printing money, but their currency is falling, when you rebase that back in dollars, that, you know, detracts from that, that it's really not growing strongly. And so as of right now, You know, when we looked at last year, peak global liquidity was running at around a 25% annual rate. And what did we see? The price multiple on the S&P was well over 30, something we hadn't really seen since the dot-com bubble. And as liquidity began to pull in, the S&P's price multiple began to come down. And when I look at as of today, that global money supply is not inflecting higher. It's still weak. And in fact, I think it will be going even lower than where it is. The reason why? Well, just look what the Fed has told us. They are shrinking their balance sheet right now by $45 billion this month. That ramps up and doubles to $95 billion next month. And they will continue shrinking their balance sheet by roughly $100 billion a month until they alter the course. So that is a massive amount of liquidity moving in reverse. When you look at the European Central Bank, they are raising rates. The Bank of England is raising rates even in a recession. The UK is struggling. Europe is struggling because of high energy prices, and they're still dealing with inflation. So they are raising rates. The Bank of Japan is really the only dovish person. But again, look at what the yen has done. The yen has collapsed almost, I think, 30% in the last year. So when you look at in dollar terms, how much money they printed, that is muted. So when you look at global money supply, Chris, we're talking about catalysts. Where's the catalyst? Where's even the hint of a catalyst? The Fed is telling us it's going to get worse, not better. They're going to accelerate their decline. The European Central Bank is not printing money like they were. No central bank is printing money like they were 2 years ago or 1 year ago. So for me, I think the price multiple is likely to go even lower from here, not higher. So when you take that plus the fact of prior tightening, that's likely to continue to put pressure on profit margins and overall earnings for corporations. You know, I'm seeing a lower price multiple, Chris, and I'm seeing lower earnings ahead. So given that, you multiply those together, it is exceptionally hard for me to paint the picture of a higher price target for stocks right here. And that's why I think, again, it would be very premature for everyone to get bowled up here, start throwing their money back into the market that they had raised earlier. That, you know, they could be sorely surprised by that.
So let's break this up into three different cases: bull case, base case, and bear case. As we discussed at the beginning of today's show, the bull case is that we have seen a major peak in inflationary pressures, that they are going to wane dramatically from here, which means that's going to take pressure off the Fed in their tightening posture. Obviously, if we were to see that, then that would be very favorable for the market outlook. And then in addition to that, we would also very likely see a soft landing. That is, either the 2 quarters of negative GDP growth that we saw in the first half of this year ends up being declared not a recession or a very mild brief recession, or whatever's taking place right now, that would fulfill the criteria for some type of soft landing event with the economy. That's the bull case. Our base case is that inflation is likely to decelerate from current levels, but it's going to remain sticky for a variety of reasons, which we've covered in the past, that this will continue to put pressure on the Fed to continue raising moving forward. And the soft landing scenario is unlikely, and that we are going to continue to see the economy contract, especially when we look at the slowdown in housing and a variety of leading economic indicators. And you've covered these extensively, the LEIs that we look at and a lot of other measures, in the weekly investment video that we post on our website and YouTube. So I would encourage all of you listening to check out those videos and see some of the indicators that we've covered. Market impacts in that case, given that base case, is that we're probably looking at a sideways volatile market. The bear case would be an exogenous event, perhaps another spike up in energy prices or some type of financial crisis or geopolitical crisis. So those things are hard to predict, but that would be the bear case. But our base case is that, you know, we should expect inflation to remain sticky. The market is likely to remain volatile in some type of sideways trading range, and that the Fed is going to maintain their tightening posture based on the stickiness of inflation moving forward. Anything you'd like to add to that as we close today's show, Chris?
You know, I did mention the price multiple and how it has a huge influence on stock returns. You know, and that's more near term, right? But what I kind of want to take a step back in bigger picture, you know, and again, why I think it's really precarious to get it all bowled up right here. Another thing I'll look at, Chris, that is more of a multiple, but a big 30,000 foot multiple, not, you know, over the next 12 months, is basically looking at animal spirits. As I mentioned, you know, multiples are often a sign of animal spirits. So high price multiples, everyone's is greedy, ebullient. And then you look at low price multiples, that's a sign of fear. Well, another multiple that I look at that historically has done a really good job on a 30,000 foot level of tracking animal spirits is follow the money. What are households doing with their financial assets? And we can get that data, Chris, and it goes back, you know, even before, basically all the way back to World War II. And essentially it comes from the Federal Reserve and it's the Household Flow of Funds Report. And it shows us essentially how much households have in stocks, how much they have in bonds, or how much they have in equity in real estate. And so when you kind of look at what if basically the typical household going all in on and relative to basically what they've sold off on. And it doesn't pay at extremes to do what everyone else has already done, meaning the money has already been bought in that asset while other assets have been sold. And there's not as much dollars to throw in. And that is looking at, again, how much households have in stocks versus bonds. And, you know, when we see major secular bull markets, they typically are where households have become despondent with stocks. They don't want to touch them with a 10-foot pole. They're in cash. They're in bonds. They're in anything but stocks. That was what we saw the late 1940s, early 50s, that ultimately led to a multi-decade bull market into the late 1960s. And conversely, after inflation ravaged everyone's holdings and stocks did very poorly in the 1970s, that ratio got all the way back down to a multiple of 2. You know, at the high going into that secular bear market, people had roughly 6 times more money in stocks than bonds. At the lows, it was down around 2. When you go to the tech bubble, we actually hit a new high. At the tech bubble, people had 8 times as much money in stocks versus bonds. At the 2009 lows, back to that magic 2 number, they had roughly, you know, $2 for every dollar they had in bonds, so a 2-to-1 ratio. Chris, at the highs this year, the amount that households had in stocks versus bonds nearly reached 18-fold. I mean, we had 18 times as much money in stocks than we did bonds. Chris, that is 3 times the ratio that we saw going into the 1970s secular bear. That is more than twice the ratio that we saw at the tech bubble. So I do want to leave that with people big picture. You know, we've got some rough roads, you know, ahead of us. You know, the market may recover to new highs. It may marginally go on. But this decade, I think we are really going to struggle to see exceptionally high stock market gains. So for anyone that is bullish and you can, you know, you have 101 reasons to list why you're bullish, you really need to think about asset allocation. Where has everyone parked their money in? And how is it that asset class will do well if everyone's already all in? So at a ratio currently right now of 16-1, that is double the tech bubble. So just wanted to leave people with that. You know, we've got a long road ahead of us, you know, over this next decade. And we have to be nimble because I do think stock returns will be subpar, especially inflation adjusted returns over the next, you know, 8 to 10 years.
So as you just pointed out, looking at the flow of funds data, investors are still over allocated to equities, that is to the stock market. So let's look at that on the flip side. What areas of the market are investors under owning that you believe do represent an opportunity moving forward?
Well, Chris, you know, that's something also that I think is really helpful to look at is where they're not invested. And, you know, in a case of that is looking at even housing, for example, how much people had equity in their homes. And in 2010, we got to one of the lowest levels in many, many decades. And in hindsight, obviously, that was a great buying opportunity in housing. So again, when you look at an asset class that is so under-owned, you know, obviously, those are typically very, very good buying opportunities. And, you know, with the significant rise in housing, you know, I can't be all bowled up on housing. I do think this will be a decade of persistently higher inflation that we're used to. And so I think bonds are going to be very problematic. There will be, you know, brief periods still on them when rates got way too high. We might have an economic downturn, but long-term secular, I'm bearish on bonds from that standpoint as well. But the one area that I think is very underowned, and I think will still, even though they've had a significant rally, is presenting a great opportunity. And it's something, Chris, we touched upon in a client letter that I wrote back in late 2020, is looking at the commodity to stock ratio. So when you look at the performance of commodities versus stocks and look at that, you know, multiple, we often see when commodities get very, very cheap relative to the S&P that they'll typically present good buying opportunities. So for example, when we look at the S&P Goldman Sachs Commodity Index divided by the S&P in the early 1970s, that ratio was 1. Meaning the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index was slightly above the S&P. By the end of, let's say, 1980, that went to a 6-to-1 ratio. The ultimate high was in the mid-70s at about a 7-to-1 ratio. So basically, commodities during that decade outperformed the S&P by 6-to-7-fold in terms of return. And then we had another kind of mini cycle in the 90s, but you know, when you look at 1990, the commodity stock ratio got to 9-to-1, meaning the Goldman Sachs commodity index was 9 times the price of the S&P. Again, you flip that around, it's a great time to get out of commodities and into stocks. And stocks then went on to a major bull market in the 1990s, ultimately leading to the tech bubble. Well, where did that drive in the S&P push that ratio down to? Right back down to the early 1970s. At roughly 1.5-to-1. And that was, again, a good buying opportunity to flip out of stocks into bonds. And from, you know, the late 1990s at a 1.5 ratio, that ultimately jumped to a high in 2008 when oil basically hit $150 a barrel. That went to an 8.25 ratio. So a huge multiple difference in terms of return, orders of magnitude versus stocks. But that was a time to sell, you know, in late 2008. Well, where are we today, Chris? At the lows, which basically were 2020, that ratio and the data I've got going back for the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index goes to basically the late 1960s. So I don't have it all the way back to the Great Depression, but that ratio got down to less than 0.5, lower than the commodity bull market that began in the late 1990s. Lower than the 1970s, where commodities exploded higher while stocks did poorly. As of right now, Chris, even though commodities have done very well, that ratio is less than 1. We're at 0.87. That's still lower than the late 1990 low in commodities and lower than the late, early 1970s. So I think commodities are a major buying opportunity here. And again, Chris, when you want to think of commodities, what ultimately drives prices are inventories. You know, because inventories are really the net result of supply and demand dynamics. And as I mentioned earlier on the show, you look at the total oil inventories in the U.S., we're at the lowest levels in decades. But inventories, comparing them now versus a long time ago, don't tell you the full picture. The economy is bigger. We have more people. We're driving more cars. So when you look at basically the oil inventory is divided by, you know, how many miles we're driving. Now, I know we're driving more electric vehicles, but when you look at gas-powered vehicles, we're literally almost at one of the lowest levels ever. So basically, the amount of oil inventories we have relative to how much we're driving and using oil is exceptionally low. We don't have any electric planes. We don't have any electric trains. So, you know, those are still very intensive, and we haven't seen a reduction in that demand. So oil inventories are exceptionally low. Aluminum, tin, nickel, zinc, I mean, even copper, almost everything is either at all-time lows, Chris, or they're in the, you know, 0 to 10 percentile. So, you know, inventories are very, very low. Margins are thin. And you have to ask yourself, where's the investment? Where's the supply going to come from? It's not. I mean, look at here in the U.S. We're not trying to increase our production. We're trying to increase others' productions with Biden going to Saudi Arabia. But we're not doing anything here. I mean, that only goes so far, and especially when Saudi Arabia says they're pretty much tapped out. So, you know, I think it's going to be, you know, the last bull market in the 2000s in commodities, that was demand driven, right? That was China entering the World Trade Organization, basically industrializing, building bridges, freeways, airports, heavy use of commodity demand. So that was basically, a demand driven commodity cycle plus the weak dollar really kind of turbocharged that. I think this commodity bull market, Chris, will be very unlike prior ones, that it won't be demand. It will be supply, that we simply will not grow supply to meet the rise in demand over time. So, you know, I would like to leave that with people to kind of think of, do what everyone else isn't. You know, the true contrarian play is not to go in and all in stocks right here. It's not housing with the huge run we've had. And it's not bonds, given where you look at interest rates. Yes, bonds yields have come down, but you look back 50, 100 years. I mean, you know, you look at where interest rates are, 10-year treasury at 2.85. I mean, are you kidding me? That's incredibly low over the last, you know, half century, 100 years of history in terms of interest rates. So bonds aren't a value. Stocks aren't a value. You know, you look at real estate, that's not really a value. The only thing that really, to me, is very compelling from a valuation perspective are commodities. So it's where basically our firm is going to be over investing. You know, we're going to be basically looking at even increasing our exposure to commodities, you know, on pullbacks. So to me, that's where the risk is, and that's where the value is as well. You know, the risk is that commodities go significantly higher. And given that likelihood, that's to me is where the best returns will likely be in the years ahead.
Chris, on that note, would you mind telling our listeners about some of the services that we provide here at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
Sure. We provide a whole host of financial services. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance.
If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with our financial advisors, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.